the ash layers on the upper slopes of Rakata were actually thin and would have been washed away by heavy rains. What if some roots and rhizomes that had been lurking beneath the surface had lived? Would they not have begun to sprout once tropic warmth and moisture and sunshine had begun to flood their now ash-free setting? Then again, the first expeditions had all noted, but had never properly investigated, the presence of greenery in the deeply scored valleys that lay between Rakata's summit ridges. Why had this greenery, whatever it was, never colonised the two lower islands, Sertung and Panjang? Why had these islands been given their vegetative resurrection much later than the upper slopes of Rakata? If airborne and seaborne immigrants were the source of this life, then all three islands should be gifted with new life at the same time. But they weren't. The upper slopes of Rakata got it first. The answer to this, and a number of similarly unconsidered conundrums Backer suggested, was that Rakata's colonisation probably came from within, that surviving plants on the island's upper slopes had created the new life there, but was an upper slope phenomenon that was entirely lacking on the islands, Sertung and Panjang, that were lower in altitude. It all made excellent sense, but it was a theory that was now, thanks to the sloppy fieldwork and hastily written conclusions of the first years after the eruption, quite impossible ever to prove. And that was the shame of it. No one could henceforth ever be sure what happened on Krakatoa's relic islets. Bad science, in short, had left mankind puzzled, a raft of questions unanswered, and the Krakatoa problem essentially unsolved and likely to remain ever insoluble. The same was not the case, however, over on Anak Krakatoa, for this was an island that was wholly new, and one whose newness precluded any possibility of there being survivors at all. Survivors of what, one might well ask. And science was not about to make the same mistake that Backer accused it of making over Krakatoa. A later director of the Botanical Gardens, Carol Dammerman, whose 1948 study of the islands became revered as the biological equal to Verbeek's famous geological study, said that in Anak Krakatoa, "We have an island originally entirely devoid of animal and vegetable life, with even a completely sterile soil. It is therefore of the utmost importance that the flora and fauna of this island should be constantly examined and at regular intervals, and it is greatly to be hoped that this unique opportunity will not be neglected, as it was in the case of Krakatoa itself." The first creatures to appear and to be noted on any of the four Anak Krakatoas, the first three of them eroded to nothing by the waves, it was the second of these that was visited by scientists, were insects. First, a very desiccated black cricket, and next, a female brown ant, both of which were already known to exist on Rakata, 2 miles distant. But their existence was cut short by the vanishing of their home, and the third Krakatoa didn't survive long enough or peacefully enough for anyone to venture out to survey it. But once the fourth edition of the island appeared in August 1930, and once it seemed to be enjoying some permanency, the scientists came out in their droves. One of the first was William Sayer Bristow, the English arachnologist who had enumerated the wild profusion of spider species on Rakata. He was sailed over to the ashy shores of Anak and in short order discovered a beetle, a mosquito, some ants, and 3 species of spider. Plants came next. 15 months after the emergence of the fourth Anak Krakatoa, the northern coast of the island was littered with floating tree stumps, bamboo stems, roots and decaying fruit. 18 seeds were discovered, and of these 10 had already taken root. Another visit added 4 more plant species to the list, all of them already well bedded in, together with moths, fungus, and a number of migratory birds, mainly sand plovers. All seemed set fair for an explosion of new life when the volcano at the edge of the new island unexpectedly and catastrophically exploded once more, and all life appeared to have been snuffed out. This was to happen 3 more times. Not until after a spasm of truly devastating eruptions in 1953 did some kind of volcanic stability return to the troubled young island, and yet then, and very unfortunately, it turned out to be 25 years more before scientists returned in any significant numbers to the region. For some curious reason, perhaps biologists were just too fearful of the region's unpredictable volcanicity, or perhaps because they were afraid of the political troubles of the Indonesia of the time, or perhaps because of more mundane reasons such as cuts in departmental budgets or the reordering of academic priorities, scientists stayed away from the new island. Carol Damerman's plea of 1948 that the world keep a very close watch on the island was widely ignored, with the result that considerably less is known today about the resettlement of the island than should be known. Krakatoa had itself suffered from bad and lazy science at the beginning of its post-eruptive phase. Now Anak Krakatoa appeared to be suffering from 25 further years of a curious insouciance and benign neglect. It was left until the 1980s for research work on both mountains to begin again in earnest. It continues to this day, with every botanist and zoologist suddenly realizing that in order to learn as much as possible about these uniquely interesting and remarkably contrasting biological situations, there's much catching up to do. The geological makeup of the new island has changed in recent years, and in the 1960s lava flows, which were hitherto unknown in the Krakatoa region, began to cascade from the crater and flow down to the sea. More than half of today's island is currently covered by congealed black lava, meaning that large areas of Anak Krakatoa, which were previously vegetated, are now barren once again. Students of island biology find this irksome, to say the least. Ian Thornton, an Australian biologist with a long-standing fascination for Anak Krakatoa, devised a simple experiment to see how rapidly insect life flooded into one of those seemingly barren lava flows. He placed plastic containers filled with seawater on top of the flows and waited to see how many airborne arthropods they might catch. In 10 days, they found 72 species, including wasps, earwigs, moths and beetles. The Aeolian tide of life appears to be quite as unstoppable as King Canute once found the sea to be. About 150 species of plant now inhabit the island. There are casuarina forests on the low and soft-soiled northeastern shore, so-called wild sugarcane, the aptly named Saccharum spontaneum, bursts out of the hot and ashy slopes. Delicate ferns are growing in the shaded parts of some of the jagged lava cliffs. Once the plants were there, providing seeds and fruit and shade and moisture, and once the insect colonies that were first to be established had grown more varied and abundant, so the birds arrived and settled. The first to do so had to be ground nesters, there being in the early years an inconvenient absence of trees, birds like the savannah nightjar, the collared kingfisher, which can build its nest in the sides of gullies, and the white-breasted waterhen, which can settle in the mesh of salt grasses at the margin of the sea. Then, once the casuarinas were tall enough to allow nesting, in came the fruit-eating and insectivorous birds like the bulbul and the crow. And as the forests thickened, so some amphibians, which had somehow found their ways across the sea, began to slink in and make their nests. Monitor lizards, paradise tree snakes, and inevitably, rats. Next, a generation of fig trees started to flourish, and fruit-eating and fig-eating pigeons and doves arrived to feed on them, and they began to jostle for space, and in doing so began to drive out some of the lesser first arrivals, among which were the ground-nesting birds whom the jungle law dictated had now probably outstayed their welcome. Raptors then took over from the doves, and in time the peregrine falcon arrived, established himself as Anak Krakatoa's avian monarch, and together with the barn owls began to feed sturdily on the rats. Thus, steadily and slowly, the population strengthened, evolving in appearance and flavour from being just a result of casual happenstance, becoming an ever more determined and rugged collection of island species that it remains today. And yet, nature proposes, but fate disposes. All of this happy development has been interrupted again and again, in the 70s and then in the 90s, by the mountain blowing its top. Today it is far from clear whether the degree to which the animals and plants that have so far consolidated themselves in a population which is now very distinctly different, both from that on the relics of old Krakatoa, as well as from the populations of Java and Sumatra, is actually going to be permitted to sustain itself. The ash and the lava that falls nearly continuously today is wreaking havoc with what could otherwise be a vastly theatrical biological experiment laid on for the world to see. What could be grand theatre turns out all too often to be just a tease. The great chain of being, an idea which has been in existence since the time of Aristotle, connects every living thing into one vast and seamless hierarchy, a system in which man, and above him the Almighty, stands at the apex. The creation of life that can be witnessed on Anak Krakatoa, and the recreation of past life that is to be seen on the relics of old Krakatoa, each offers an illustration of the processes that lie at the lower end of this grand and somewhat fanciful scale. And in both places the processes are, though varied in detail, in fact remarkably similar. Both processes seem to have begun with the makings of films of bacteria, which clung to the beds of volcanic ash and coated the ragged, burned ruins of once hot rock. Matters got properly underway with, on the one hand, the arrival of fungi and simple grasses, and on the other with the addition of spiders and crickets and beetles. The process continued with the establishment of ferns and orchids and more general plants, a mix of botanies into which were eased the herbivorous birds and a scattering of small animals. Then came the fruit and the fruit-eating insects and the perching, nesting birds, and finally the larger animals with teeth and snapping jaws, and that in time would prey on all of these. The list is seamless, the great chain set down for all to see. Bacteria, plant, insect, fruit, herbivore, carnivore. It's the classic development of life, a development a little more complicated on old Krakatoa, perhaps, because of what lived there before and may have survived, but in all other senses, and assuredly so on Anak Krakatoa, entirely classic. To the outside world, the eruption of 1883 may have spelled death and devastation. To the world of biology and botany, however, the subsequent energetic happenings on the islands in the Sunda Strait represent nothing more or less than a freeze-frame picture of the future of life itself, a demonstration of the utterly confident way that the world, however badly it has been wounded, picks itself up, continues to unfold its magic and its marvels, and sets itself back on its endless trail of evolutionary progress yet again. The crucible of life turns out to be the most difficult of vessels to break. Not even the world's most dangerous volcano can do it truly irreparable damage. Epilogue. The place the world exploded. The cars that sweep swiftly southwards along what passes for West Java's Corniche have to be prepared for all manner of delay and interruption. Lumbering bullock carts, stalled lorries, lurching cyclists drunk on palm wine, sprawling street fairs and impromptu political demonstrations, undisciplined scatterings of chickens and goats and cattle, and on every corner of the roadway small children, children everywhere. It's frustrating driving. By the time the cars reach the outskirts of the small town of Charita, few on board will be in any mood to notice a small, undistinguished and yellowing wooden structure that is set well back from the road at the north end of town on the brow of a low hill above a tapioca plantation. Most probably those passing, especially if they're from afar, and Charita is these days a seaside holiday destination, so the coast road is frequently crowded with prosperous Indonesian families trying to escape the oppressive heat and crush of Jakarta, will be looking to their right, and not to where the building stands on their left, for on the right-hand side, the west, the view is quite soothingly magical, especially so at about 6 each evening when the sun is setting over the distant blue hills of Sumatra. Just as in an old Chinese watercolour, so the shades of evening blue seem to merge in an infinite series of layers. The deep aquamarine of the sea in the foreground, the bold azure of the darkening twilight sky, the pale powder blue of the Sumatran mountains behind, and in between them the scattering of islands of the Krakatoa archipelago, edged in pastel blues that are dark or light according to their distance, or which change with the shadows that the islands cast upon one another, or as the smoke that is usually rising from the peak in the centre of the group drifts and curls above and around about them. And yes, you find yourself saying to yourself in an almost incredulous whisper, this is where it all happened. This is Krakatoa, the place with a name now firmly annealed into the language, welded into the world's public consciousness, a name that has become a byword for nature's most fearsome potential for destruction. The steep, sharp, instantly recognisable peak on the left-hand side of the little cluster of islands is Rakata, the dead relic, the ruined husk of the great eruption. The low and less distinguished islands of Panjang and Sertung hug the horizon, the wrecked parentheses of the ancient caldera. Sometimes, in certain lights, they can be tricky to distinguish against the pale backcloth of Sumatra. Their distances seem compressed, so that from the Java shore they look as though they are a single uninterrupted island, even though they are in fact two, and one is a good deal closer to shore than the other. And then, rising from the midpoint of the pair, in fact almost exactly in the middle of the neat little archipelago, is a peak that, though lower than Rakata, has at this distance and from this angle the shape of a perfectly formed cone, with a plume of smoke sometimes rising slowly above it, and on the line where mountain top and smoke cloud meet, a sinister, beautiful, ominous-looking orange glow of fire. This is the centrepiece of the tableau, both in fact and in fable. This is the dangerously fast-growing adolescent child of the cataclysm, Anak Krakatoa. The beauty and strange menace of the scene is memorable. Small wonder that passing southbound motorists are generally enraptured and look steadily across the sea to their right. The yellow-painted buildings above the tapioca trees on their left hold no attraction at all, and they are generally ignored, passed by, and if glimpsed at all, instantly forgotten. Perhaps they should not be, for the buildings are the field station of the Krakatoa Volcanic Observatory, and in one of the simply furnished rooms within the small cluster of structures there is a device. Its electronics a little long in the tooth these days, but its metal casing and dials and the instrumentation inside cleaned and oiled and cared for still, that measures, as exactly as it is possible to measure, what is going on beneath the earth below Krakatoa. This is the machine that will warn the region, the country, and the world, one hopes, in the unlikely event that things begin to go awry. The device, which many years ago was gifted by the Americans, is designed to alert all those in Indonesia whose task it is to watch out for signs of trouble, the civil defence agencies, the army, local hospitals, managers of food depots and blanket stores, and everyone who lives in those low-lying coastal areas that might be inundated by tides if another catastrophic eruption is deemed imminent. The technology is simple enough. Some years ago, a group of geologists from the Geological Survey of Indonesia and the US Geological Survey installed an array of seismic sensors on Anak Krakatoa, scattering some into clefts in the lava surface and settling others into holes drilled some few feet into the slopes of the mountain. The sensors were then connected to a coder and to a radio transmitter built into a tough aluminium box. This box was then buried in a trench dug on the eastward-facing, Java-facing slope of the island, a couple of hundred feet above the sea, and in line of sight with the observatory that was at the same time being built over to the north of Charita. A solar panel on the mast above the buried box assured an uninterrupted source of power, and so a seamless flow of signals, such that night or day of every year, what was happening seismically on this potentially most violent centre of the Krakatoa complex would be sent instantly across the strait to be picked up by the cluster of radio aerials that rise above the yellow-painted, rarely noticed and insignificant little observatory. The rules laid down by the Volcanological Survey of Indonesia require that there always be at least one observer on duty inside the building. When I stopped by, the point man was a thin, tired-looking and rather nervous 40-year-old named Sikin, who lived in a nearby village. When we met, he was midway through his week-long shift, keeping the world's most notorious volcano under close invigilation, a duty for which he was paid the equivalent of $50 a month, together with a substantial ration of rice. He occupied two of the observatory's rooms. The others were assigned to the survey's chief, whose office was 80 miles away in Bandung, and who stopped by only in the event of an emergency. In one of Sikin's pair of rooms there was just a cot and a hand basin. In the other, under a formal portrait of the current Indonesian president, and on a trestle table beneath which were four large 12-volt car batteries, was the monitoring machine itself, a black and silver chrome box with a metal plate identifying it as a radio seismograph made by a venerable American earthquake measuring company known as Kinematics Incorporated. There is a needle, a large revolving drum, and a sheet of paper changed every 12 hours, and on it a series of traces done in purple ink recording second by second the activity across on and deep beneath the island. Today's trace indicated only the merest of trembles. The night before, the needle had waved unsteadily for a few hours in the middle of the night, and the week before, Sikkin took the trace down from a cardboard folder on a shelf above the recorder, the lines were crazed as though someone had shaken the inked needle in a sudden fit of anger. The lines were blurred and entwined together because the needle had been vibrating and wavering back and forth both at a great frequency and with considerable amplitude. That week, Anak Krakatoa had clearly undergone a spasm of some sort. Not enough of one, however, for Sikkin, as he said, to have called out his superiors in survey headquarters over in Bandung. A routine eruption, he said, of which last week's had been a classic of the kind, was nothing to get excited about. Anak Krakatoa is like a great safety valve, blowing off steam and a good deal else besides on a regular basis, never holding itself back and distorting itself dangerously, with an enormous relieving eruption as the culminating climax. Generally speaking, it is the active volcanoes that do not erupt that are the dangerous ones. Inside them, energy is being stored up little by little until the stresses become too great and there is a catastrophe. On Anak Krakatoa, there's continual release, which may look dramatic and may, on occasion, make for trouble and cause casualties, but which suggests that in the short term at least, the danger is predictable and any crisis is manageable. So long as the volcano is watched, current belief has it, the neighbourhood is safe. A routine eruption is invariably visible from the shore some minutes before it's detected by the seismometers and is then written onto the seismograph drum. That recent bad day's eruption, it was a Sunday afternoon, Sikkin remembered, and he was standing at the observatory door puffing on his clove-flavoured Kretek cigarette, began with a sudden whoosh of dust and smoke that could be seen pouring from a vent just behind the obvious main summit of Anak. He said that he watched for a moment only, counting the seconds by snapping his fingers. He walked back to the kinematics machine, and sure enough, 10 seconds after the first sight of smoke, after 10 snaps of his fingers, so the needle began to move. There was at first a great swing, several inches to one side, after which it slammed back to the other side so fiercely it might look to a stranger as though the needle might break. Then it moved back again and again and again, the trace righting itself on top of itself, but with movements that were now diminishing somewhat as the drum unrolled, so that the record began to look like an arrowhead, tapering towards a point. It was a familiar pattern, one remembered distantly from old newspaper pictures or images on museum walls at places that had suffered badly from seismic shocks, places like Skopje and Anchorage in Istanbul, or the volcanoes of Mount St. Helens or Unzen. Sikkin was still clicking his fingers while he watched the machine's passionless unrolling, until another 5 seconds had passed, when he went over to the open doorway and cocked an ear. Sure enough, and right on cue, there came from across the strait a rumble, like distant thunder or the shaking of a theatrical thunder sheet, and then silence. Below him, behind the tapioca plants, he could see that the masts of the prahus in the river had begun to swing back and forth as the craft shook at their moorings. The sea surface had the sudden look of hammered pewter. Until the swell took over, the breeze ruffled away any pattern that might have been briefly imposed upon it, and everything returned to normal. Across on the mountain the smoke had now lifted away from the summit, which was now quite clear. The billow of black had risen well into the sky and was being borne away southwards in the streaming winds, otherwise the sky was cloudless. Soon there was just the single ragged blot floating in the air, and the traces written on the paper drum, to stand as a record of how Anak Krakatoa had once again reminded the surrounding world that it was still very much alive. And of those two records, only the paper would survive. In 6 months' time a car would arrive to take it, and all the rest away, to be stored in a damp basement in Bandung. It's not entirely clear whether one is formally allowed to visit Krakatoa today. The archipelago is part of a national park, is a protected treasure, can be dangerous on occasion, and in theory is officially off-limits to those without government sanction. The bureaucrats, safely in their offices in Jakarta, fret over the scrapes that visitors might get themselves into. People have been killed or injured on the island, hit by flying lava bombs. The Sunda Strait suffers from notoriously fickle winds and seas, is crowded with fast-moving cargo ships, and the deep waters are alive with hungry sharks. The local vessels commonly used for the crossing break down with a depressing regularity. Few Americans will forget the fate of the 27-year-old Californian women Ricky Berkowitz and Judy Schwartz, who, trying to cross to Krakatoa in 1985, found themselves drifting in a leaky open boat for 3 weeks, surviving gamely on a diet of peanuts, rainwater and Crest toothpaste. In Bandung, I'd been handed a piece of paper dripping with official permit stamps and signatures, and told that just this once, an exception to the normal rule, I might be allowed to go to Krakatoa on my own. But in Charita, it was perfectly evident that no one gave a thought about ever getting permission, and that whether it was allowed or not, going across to Krakatoa was simply, like so much in the East, a matter of nothing more than supply and demand. If you wanted to go then for a price, go you most assuredly could and would. And so, early one morning on a Charita beach that was already swarming with boys selling shells, sarongs, fried squid, coconuts and kites, and with cheerful young women offering very un-Islamic-sounding full-body massages, and with broad winks that promised even more delights, there were groups of young men who pestered me slyly, as though in a Saharan souk, hissing theatrically, "You like go Krakatoa?" Consequently, within an hour or so, and after I had looked critically at the small armada of boats on offer, I had selected a sleek yellow wooden pinisi, a fishing craft with a reliable-looking 70-horsepower Evinrude engine, had found a guide with the improbable name of Boing, and had waded out into the surf and clambered aboard. The skipper first made a drama of unfurling his national flag and tying it with twine to the jackstaff. It turned out that just by chance we were sailing on the 17th of August, which was the anniversary of Sukarno's famous Proclamation of Independence in 1945. With a mischievous grin, the captain then pulled up a case of Bintang beer from the cool waters down in the bilges, tossed a couple of cans each to his two shipmates and to Boeing and to me, waved a salute to something that sounded like the glories of Indonesian freedom and the likely continuation of good post-colonial living, burped, hiccuped, gunned his engine noisily, bounced his boat through the green heaps of surf, and finally sped off unsteadily into the open waters of the strait and towards the hazy western horizon. From sea level and early on this hazy morning it wasn't possible to see the archipelago until we'd been cruising steadily west for about half an hour. I spent those first minutes gazing up at a frigate bird high above us, flicking his scissor-like tails to change direction. There were dolphins, too, playing under the bow, and flying fish launching themselves like little missiles, darting across the troughs between adjacent swells. And then the skipper nudged me out of my reverie. "Rakata," he cried, and sure enough, rising through the haze directly ahead of us, was the perfect pyramid shape of the last relic piece of old Krakatoa. To its right, as I squinted into the distance, I could soon make out the smaller cone of Anak Krakatoa, a puff of white smoke rising above it, and a slash of white running across the face of the mountain, a lava flow that had so far escaped weathering by the elements. The driver indicated that it was as well the smoke rising above the volcano was white. If it turned grey, if it was filled with debris, in other words, then it would be time to think about leaving. Fast. Between our position now and the islands ahead were the main north and southbound shipping lanes of the Sunda Strait, and for a half hour negotiating them seemed to occupy the skipper's mind more keenly than the colour of Krakatoa's smoke, for the lanes were very busy, and when you're in a small craft down at sea level, the immense speed of the onrushing cargo ships is almost impossible to calculate. There was, for example, the northbound container vessel which, when we first saw her, was a mere speck on our port horizon. Within 5 minutes, however, this speck had become a massive ship, whose hull side proclaimed her as belonging to COSCO, the China Overseas Shipping Company, and she was bearing down on us with an awful speed. We cut our engine and let her pass us, and when she did so she must have been no more than 500 yards ahead. The nub of her bulbous bow elbowed the waves aside, setting us rocking alarmingly as we sat, hove to, and watched her immense bulk slide cinematically in front of us. And then she was passed safely. An enormous screw thrashed wildly in front of the huge rudder, and as she drew away to our starboard, we could see her name written in Chinese and her port of registry, Shanghai. She was on her way home, back from a voyage probably to ports in Africa and the east coast of South America. There was no indication that she ever saw us. Quite probably such crew as were on the bridge were standing on her own port side, gazing from their vantage point across at the world-famous volcanoes. Once she was safely gone, we sliced and bumped across her mile-wide wake, dodged another couple of smaller southbound ships, and edged in towards the lumpy, confused-looking waters of the volcanic caldera itself. The boat began to lurch alarmingly again here, as though we were passing through a line of rapids. The skipper grinned. He knew how strange a phenomenon this was. The submerged lip of the old caldera, it seemed, was somehow playing havoc with the tides and the currents, tripping up the streams, creating a ring of intersecting overfalls that broke all around us in ragged rings of white and green. We edged closer, coming to within half a mile of Rakata's huge vertical cliff, which was blindingly lit by the midday sun. From this close and at this angle it displayed a textbook cross-section of a wrecked volcano, with a dark central vertical spire of the old core and its sheared-off surface pierced by dozens of veins of long-frozen pipes of lava, the whole cone capped high up in the sky by a ragged crown of trees. And then we were through the broken waters and into the belly of the thing, the omphalos of the Oriental world, a place where the waters were unimaginably deep once more and, down in their depths, where unimaginable things were happening. Within the caldera, Rakata was large enough to shut out some of the northbound swells and to divert the currents, and so once we were inside the submerged walls and in Rakata's lee, the sea suddenly became calmer, more congenial. The boat stopped its corkscrewing and resumed a more steadily upright putter to shore. We set a course first towards the strange tilted aggregation of guano-covered rocks called Bosun's Rocks, around which the waves gnawed hungrily. We turned slightly to port just as we seemed ready to touch them and left them to our starboard and headed to the south side of Anak Krakatoa itself. The plan was to circumnavigate the island before landing on the beach on the eastern side. The skipper was showing off now, and he liked to hug the shore for my benefit. The island, the child of Krakatoa, now an enormous black bulk just a few feet off to our right, smoked contentedly and calmly, and the smoke, we all noted, remained steadily white. Most of the western and northern shores of the island consisted of dark grey lava flows, and the one paler flow, newer than the rest, that I had seen from afar. They were all horrible, gnarly things, mostly quite unweathered, with rocky tentacles that probed into the sea, where the waves washed around them and sucked hungrily underneath them. The land above the flows was spiky and crammed with razor-sharp cliffs of frozen basalt. Once in a while I could see a single red flower sunning itself from within a cleft, and seabirds would perch on the highest points, surveying the world around them. But otherwise the flows were lifeless and harsh, the raw front edge of the volcanic process all solidified into hundreds of yards of dead, unyielding and ugly black rock. The crater itself was invisible from here, the smoke column, though, wafted ever upwards. Once we were around the eastern side, however, the island took on a completely different aspect. The slope, down from the now visible summit, became much less pronounced, and instead of lava there was ash, and, in places closer to the beach, ashy soil. It had been transmuted into soil because, fringing the eastern and northern flanks of the island, there was now a long copse of trees, and over time, though not very much time since the island had only been born in 1930, they had died and fallen over and decayed, and their corpses had mingled with the ash to produce, to judge from the gorgeous fecundity of the growth all around, a wonderfully humus-rich substrate. From this vantage point, indeed, Anak Krakatoa looked like a perfectly normal tropical island, with no suggestion that it was one of the youngest islands in the world. And it was towards its fringing woodlands that the skipper directed his boat. We dropped an anchor 50 feet from shore, we splashed through the shallows up onto the scalding beach. There was a path through the casuarina trees. We walked in as quickly as we could. The sand was far too hot, from the pitiless sun or the volcanic origins of the sand I couldn't be sure, to allow any dawdling. And we set up camp in a grove where we'd build a fire and take our lunch. It looked for all the world as though we were in a tropical forest. The vegetation was thick and dripping with dampness. Butterflies swirled in the thermals, birds called from high up in the canopy, and one of the boat's crew showed me a nest of what he said was an owl. There were the footprints of rats and geckos. The fine pumice sand was alive with ghost crabs, which skittered delicately along on tiptoe, as if keeping away from the heat. And along one patch of sand, close to where we were eating, there were the tracks of some much larger animal, about which the crewmen only grinned ominously. After eating grilled fish and rice and drinking the remains of the bintang, Boying and I set off uphill. The crewman had in any case fallen asleep in the shade, making us promise beforehand that we'd return 2 hours before nightfall, or risk being run down by a freighter if we tried to cross the Sunda Strait after dark. It should, in any case, take no more than an hour to reach the summit, and at Krakatoa was, remember, only 1,500 feet high. But of course, climbing a third of a mile up a high hill made only of new-fallen ash is a far from easy occupation. First, there was the simple matter of getting out of the coastal forest, 100 feet of thick, lush vegetation, through which he had to hack our way until it ended abruptly, with a patch of low grasses and a sudden blaze of brilliant sunlight as we emerged right onto the naked flank of the volcano. Not only was it unbelievably hot here, and this the kind of heat that drills painfully up through the soles of even the best insulated of shoes, but the ash that rose up steadily ahead slipped and slid, and opened up into scores of small chasms and runnels and rills, such that for every 5 steps upward I fell backwards 4. We passed the aluminium box with its radio aerial pointed directly at the faraway and at this time invisible coast of Java. Sikkin would be there, I fancied, watching the paper roll steadily out from the kinematics drum, with nary a vibration other than from my feet coming from his charge. The island was quiet this day, and judging from the column of pure white smoke that coiled up from the summit ahead, was likely to remain so at least for a while. But it had evidently not been so quiet very recently. As we climbed higher, so on all sides there were hundreds of rocks that had clearly whistled down from on high after a furious eruption and had crashed into the sides of the hill. Craters had formed in the ash around where the rocks had fallen, just as though there had been bombs or artillery shells exploding. The craters gave the surface the curious appearance of the landscape of Ypres or Passchendaele, only here it was dry, not muddy, and sloping, not flat. Some of the lava bombs had been huge, some as large as a motorbus, and whenever we edged past one of these, with Boying laughing in the way that only Javanese can laugh, with their fatalistic attitude to all happenings, good and bad, I confess that I looked up in the sky, moderately apprehensive. If Anak Krakatoa decided on a tectonic whim to hurl one of those into the sky, then gravity would ensure that life for those below could become very short and concentrated indeed. Up we trudged, until we reached a point where the last grasses, tall clumps of the so-called wild sugar cane, Saccharum spontaneum, petered out, and the landscape became nothing more than ash, bomb craters, smoke, and the ever-widening panorama of the sky. The skyline itself was quite near, and when after 10 minutes more or so I breasted the ridge, panting, perspiring, glad it was all over, I was actually surprised at how easy it had all been. I stood tall on top of a truck-sized lava bomb and took in the immense view. I gazed down at our island, at the curved cusp of the grove of trees by the beach below, at the black sand shore, and at our yellow Panisi, tiny and fragile, swinging on her anchor. I gazed down at the lava flows, great black frozen rivers of coiled and frozen magma that had not so long ago been pouring down into the boiling ocean. I looked over at the jagged outcrop of Bosun's Rock, welling out of its private froth of surf, and over to the low island of Panjang to the east, and the immense half-conical wall of Rakata directly ahead. And then I tried to look across at where the archipelago's other island of Sertung might lie. Only at this point I was suddenly confronted by an immense wall of sloping grey ash that rose high, high above me. What foolishness, I suddenly realised, what a mistake to have made. The relief I might have briefly felt at supposedly reaching the summit of Krakatoa's child vanished in an instant. It turned out that I was not even halfway up the mountain. Where I stood was no more than a false crater, the mere relict rim of a much earlier eruption. Anak Krakatoa's widely feared active crater, the summit of the volcano and the site from behind which the eruptive smoke was even now billowing, was yet another long, long slog up and away. There was nothing for it. Boying and I slogged away manfully upwards once more, as we were duty-bound to do, slipping and sliding ourselves generally and painfully up and up, in the fierce heat and dazzling sunshine, ever wary of what mischief the mountain might be planning for us. The sky widened further and further. The sea below became a dazzling, gleaming sheet of steel. The temperature rose in an almost terrifying way that seemed to have no relation to the tropical sun, until, after 30 wearying minutes more, we stepped over a rock edged with a crust of yellow-stained sulphur crystals, and across the teeth of a ridge below which, spread ahead like some infernal dish of hell, was the crater itself. The white smoke had by now enveloped us. It was hot water vapour, mixed with the curiously attractive smell of sulphur dioxide and dust. The surface, I could see ahead, was a fragile-looking crust, newly baked and broken in places, with plopping gobbets of hot mud spurting into the air and hissing machine-like jets of gas roaring and whistling up into the cloud. From afar, the volcano had appeared quiet, but from up here, on the very lip of its mouth, at the working end of the heir apparent to the greatest volcano the modern world has experienced, it seemed anything but. The mechanics of the making of the world were all in evidence, just a few feet ahead of where I stood. All this talk of subduction zones, of the collisions between two of the world's immense tectonic plates, of the unfolding of the ring of fire, it all came down to this. Here, in this hot, crystalline, yellow-grey, wheezing, whistling, mud-boiling cauldron, was where all the consequences of subduction were being played out. The power of the process was all too apparent here also, in the strangely compelling symphony of grindings and snortings and sulphurous snarlings, in all the rushings of yellow and green gases, and the snapping and straining of the rocks and crystals and crusts. This was a place that was filled with nameless and unfathomable activities, and it had a dreadful, fascinating menace. It was a place that was all too evidently primed, ready at an instant to explode again, and in exploding and erupting, to do goodness knows how much harm to goodness knows how many souls waiting unwittingly down below. After a while, the sulphur began to catch in my throat, and Boeing started to become anxious that we might in any case be staying too long. And so we trudged downhill for the last time, soon glissading through clouds of ash, passing at a run the observatory radio transmitter and the clumps of sugarcane, before meeting the fringe of the woods and diving thankfully through the final few hundred feet into the comparative cool of the shade of the seaside casuarina trees. The crew had gone out to ready their boat for the journey back to Java, and Boeing swam over to talk to them. I was peckish, and I pulled out from my haversack a squashed chicken sandwich made for me in the hotel before we left. I sat on the trunk of a fallen tree in the quiet, reflecting on the afternoon and on the awesome, epicentral, deeply symbolic place above, and which I had been fortunate enough to see. And then I heard a rustling, crackling sound in the woods, a strangely, unearthly noise that made the hairs rise suddenly all along the nape of my neck. I stopped eating and looked round. There was no other sound, not even from the boatmen, who were by now probably well out of earshot. The rustling continued, and it got louder, until, suddenly breaking out of the cover of the jungle, emerged the head, and then the body of a 6-foot-long lizard, waddling slowly and steadily towards me, its jaws wide open. It was a horrible, strange, weirdly shaped creature, a long, fat, brown body with what looked like a thick seam of flesh running the length of its midsection. As it walked, its tail thrashed from side to side, and from its small, flat-topped head a tongue, a foot or more long, flickered in and out, menacingly. The beast, as a whole, did indeed look menacing, and very dangerous indeed. Deep down, I knew that it was probably quite harmless, and that it was in all likelihood simply a specimen of the great five-banded monitor, the wonderful swimming lizard known to Javanese as the Biawak, and to science as Varanus salvator. But that deeper realization came only later in the day, at the precise moment on that August afternoon when it emerged from the trees, when I was sitting quite alone in the jungle, on the side of a hot and very active volcano, the animal looked like nothing so much as a fully-fledged dragon, and I was more than a little alarmed by his arrival on the scene. So I threw him my chicken sandwich. He took one disdainful look at it, looked up briefly at me, and then grabbed between his wicked-looking teeth the Charita Beach Hotel kitchen's doubtless carefully prepared confection of chicken and white bread, and skittered off back into the darkness of the jungle, his armour-plated tail thrashing its valedictory. And then I got up cautiously from my tree, and, with as much dispatch as was consonant with the dignity of the occasion, I walked down to the shore and onto the sand and hurried through the cooling waves out to where the yellow fishing boat was waiting. I decided not to say what I had seen. The crew were impatient for home, and we set off eastwards at such a speed that before long the cone of Anak Krakatoa and the relic ruins of the world's greatest volcano were all sliding down astern of us and merging with the horizon and the setting sun. And as we sailed on into the gathering dark, so the twinkling lights of the west of Java were coming up fast over the bow.
Now, as a bonus, a brief excerpt of Simon Winchester reading from his New York Times bestseller, available from Harper Audio, The Professor and the Madman.
Harper Audio presents The Professor and the Madman, a tale of murder, insanity, and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. Written and read by Simon Winchester. This book is dedicated to the memory of G.M. Preface. Mysterious. Adjective. Full of or fraught with mystery. Wrapped in mystery. Hidden from human knowledge or understanding. Impossible or difficult to explain, solve, or discover. Of obscure origin, nature, or purpose. Popular myth has it that one of the most remarkable conversations in modern literary history took place on a cool and misty late autumn afternoon in 1896 in the small village of Crowthorne in the county of Berkshire. One of the parties to the colloquy was the formidable Dr. James Murray, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. On the day in question, he had travelled 50 miles by train from Oxford to meet an enigmatic figure named Dr. W.C. Minor, who was among the most prolific of the thousands of volunteer contributors whose labours lay at the core of the dictionary's creation. For very nearly 20 years beforehand, these two men had corresponded regularly about the finer points of English lexicography, but they had never met. Dr. Minor seemed never willing or able to leave his home at Crowthorne, never willing to come to Oxford. He was unable to offer any kind of explanation, or to do more than offer his regrets. Dr. Murray, who himself was rarely free from the burdens of his work at the dictionary headquarters, the famous Scriptorium in Oxford, had nonetheless long dearly wished to see and thank his mysterious and intriguing helper. And particularly so by the late 1890s, with the dictionary well on its way to being half completed. Official honours were being showered upon all its creators, and Murray wanted to make sure that all those involved, even men so apparently bashful as Dr. Minor, were recognised for the valuable work they'd done. He decided he'd pay a visit. Once he had made up his mind to go, he telegraphed his intentions, adding that he'd find it most convenient to take a train that arrived at Crowthorne Station, then actually known as Wellington College Station, since it served the famous boys' school situated in the village, just after 2 on a certain Wednesday in November. Dr. Minor sent a wire by return to say that he was indeed expected and would be made most welcome. On the journey from Oxford, the weather was fine, The trains were on time. The auguries, in short, were good. At the railway station, a polished landau and a liveried coachman were waiting, and with James Murray aboard, they clip-clopped back through the lanes of rural Berkshire. After 20 minutes or so, the carriage turned up a long drive lined with tall poplars, drawing up eventually outside a huge and rather forbidding red-brick mansion. A solemn servant showed the lexicographer upstairs and into a book-lined study, where behind an immense mahogany desk stood a man of undoubted importance. Dr. Murray bowed gravely and launched into the brief speech of greeting that he had so long rehearsed. "A very good afternoon to you, sir. I'm Dr. James Murray of the London Philological Society and editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. It's indeed an honour and a pleasure to at long last make your acquaintance, for you must be, kind sir, my most assiduous helpmeet, Dr. W.C. Minor." There was a brief pause, a momentary air of mutual embarrassment. A clock ticked loudly. There were muffled footsteps in the hall, a distant clank of keys. And then the man behind the desk cleared his throat, and he spoke. "I regret, kind sir, that I'm not. It's not at all as you suppose. I am, in fact, the governor of the Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum. Dr. Minor's most certainly here, but he is an inmate. He's been a patient here for more than 20 years. He's our longest-staying resident." Although the official government files relating to this case are secret and have been locked away for more than a century, I've recently been allowed to see them. What follows is the strange, tragic, and yet spiritually uplifting story that they reveal. The dead of night in Lambeth Marsh. Murder. Noun. The most heinous kind of criminal homicide, also an instance of this, in English, also Scottish and American law, defined as the unlawful killing of a human being with malicious aforethought, often more explicitly, willful murder. In Old English, the word could be applied to any homicide that was strongly reprobated. It had also the senses great wickedness, deadly injury, torment. More strictly, however, it denoted secret murder, which in Germanic antiquity was alone regarded as, in the modern sense, a crime, open homicide being considered a private wrong calling for blood revenge or compensation. Even under Edward I, Britain explains the ancient French meurtre only as felonious homicide of which both the perpetrator and the victim are unidentified. The malice aforethought, which enters into the legal definition of murder, does not, as now interpreted, admit of any summary definition. A person may even be guilty of willful murder without intending the death of the victim, as when death results from an unlawful act which the doer knew to be likely to cause the death of someone, or from injuries inflicted to facilitate the commission of certain offences. It is essential to murder that the perpetrator be of sound mind, and, in England, though not in Scotland, that death should ensue within a year and a day after the act presumed to have caused it. In British law, no degrees of guilt are recognised in murder. In the US, the law distinguishes murder in the first degree, where there are no mitigating circumstances, and murder in the second degree. In Victorian London, even in a place as louche and notoriously crime-ridden as Lambeth Marsh, the sound of gunshots was a rare event indeed. The Marsh was a sinister place, a jumble of slums and sin that crouched dark and ogre-like on the bank of the Thames just across from Westminster. Few respectable Londoners would ever admit to venturing there. It was a robustly violent part of town as well. The footpad lurked in Lambeth. There had once been an outbreak of garrotting, and in every crowded alley were the roughest kinds of pickpocket. Fagin, Bill Sykes and Oliver Twist would have all seemed quite at home in Victorian Lambeth. This was Dickensian London, writ large. But it was not a place for men with guns. The armed criminal was a phenomenon little known in the Lambeth of Prime Minister Gladstone's day, and even less known in the entire metropolitan vastness of London. Guns were costly, cumbersome, difficult to use, hard to conceal. Then, as still today, the use of a firearm in the commission of a crime was thought of as somehow a very un-British act, as something to be written about and recorded as a rarity. "Happily," proclaimed a smug editorial in Lambeth's weekly newspaper, "we in this country have no experience of the crime of shooting down, so common in the United States." So, when a brief fusillade of three revolver shots rang out shortly after 2 o'clock on the moonlit Saturday morning of February the 17th, 1872, the sound was unimagined, unprecedented, and shocking. The three cracks, perhaps there were four, were loud, very loud, and they echoed through the cold and smokily damp night air. They were heard, and considering their rarity, just by chance instantly recognised, by a keen young police constable named Henry Tarrant, then attached to the Southwark Constabulary's L Division. The clocks had only recently struck two, his notes said later. He was performing with routine languor the duties of the graveyard shift, walking slowly beneath the viaduct arches beside Waterloo Railway Station, rattling the locks of the shops and cursing the bone-numbing chill. When he heard the shots, Tarrant blew his whistle to alert any colleagues who, he hoped, might be on patrol nearby, and he began to run. Within seconds he had raced through the warren of mean and slippery lanes that made up what in those days was still called a village, and he'd emerged into the wide riverside swath of Belvedere Road, from whence he was certain the sounds had come. Another policeman, Henry Burton, who had heard the piercing whistle, as had a third, William Ward, rushed to the scene. According to Burton's notes, he dashed towards the echoing sound and came across his colleague Tarrant, who was by then holding a man as if arresting him. "Quick!" cried Tarrant. "Go to the road. A man's been shot." Burton and Ward raced towards Belvedere Road and within seconds found the unmoving body of a dying man. They fell to their knees, and onlookers noted that they had cast off their helmets and gloves and were hunched over the victim. There was blood gushing onto the pavement, blood staining a spot that would, for many months afterward, be described by London's more dramatically minded papers as the location of a heinous crime, a terrible event, an atrocious occurrence, a vile murder. The Lambeth tragedy, the papers eventually settled upon calling it, as if the simple existence of Lambeth itself were not something of a tragedy. Yet this was a most unusual event, even by the diminished standards of the marsh dwellers. For though the place where the killing occurred had over the years been witness to many strange events, the kind eagerly chronicled in the Penny Dreadfuls, this particular drama was to trigger a chain of consequences that was quite without precedent. And while some aspects of this crime and its aftermath would turn out to be sad and barely believable, not all of them, as this account will show, were to be wholly tragic. Far from it, indeed. Even today, Lambeth is a singularly unlovely part of the British capital, jammed anonymously between the great fan of roads and railway lines that take commuters in and out of the city centre from the southern counties. These days, the Royal Festival Hall and the South Bank Centre stand there, built on the site of the 1951 fairgrounds, where an entertainment was staged to help cheer up the rationed and threadbare Londoners. Otherwise, it's an unlovely, characterless sort of place, rows of prison-like buildings that house the lesser government ministries, the headquarters of an oil company around which winter winds whip bitterly, a few unmemorable pubs and newspaper shops, and the lowering presence of Waterloo Station, lately expanded with the terminal for the Channel Tunnel express trains, which exerts its dull magnetic pull over the neighbourhood. The railway chiefs of old never bothered to build a grand station hotel at Waterloo, though they did build monster structures of great luxury at the other London stations like Victoria and Paddington, and even St Pancras and King's Cross. Lambeth has long been one of the nastier parts of London, until very recently, with the further development of the Festival Hall site, no one of any style and consequence has ever wanted to linger there, neither a passenger back in the days of the Victorian boat trains, nor anyone for any reason at all today. It's slowly improving, but its reputation dogs it. 100 years ago, it was positively vile. It was still then low, marshy and undrained, a swampy gyre of pathways where a sad little stream called the Neckinger seeped into the Thames. The land was jointly owned by the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Duke of Cornwall, landlords who, rich enough in their own right, never bothered to develop it in the manner of the great lords of London, Grosvenor, Bedford and Devonshire, who created the squares, mansions and terraces on the far side of the river. So it was instead a place of warehouses, tenant shacks and miserable rows of ill-built houses. There were blacking factories, shoe polish makers like the one in which the young Charles Dickens worked, and there were soap boilers, small firms of dyers and lime burners, and tanning yards where the leather workers used a substance for darkening skins that was known as pure, and that was gathered from the streets each night by the filthiest of the local indigents, pure being a Victorian term for dog turds. A sickly smell of yeast and hops lay over the town, wafting from the chimneys of the great Red Lion Brewery, which stood on Belvedere Road just north of the Hungerford Bridge. And this bridge was symbolic of what encompassed the entire marsh, the railways hefted high over the swamps on viaducts on which the trains, including those of the London Necropolis Railway, built to take corpses to the cemeteries in the suburb of Woking, chuffed and snorted, and across which miles of wagons lurched and banged. Lambeth was widely regarded as one of the noisiest and most sulphurous parts of a capital that had already a grim reputation for din and dirt. Lambeth Marsh was also, as it happened, just beyond the legal jurisdiction of both the cities of London and Westminster. It belonged administratively, at least until 1888, to the county of Surrey, meaning that the relatively strict laws that applied to the capital's citizens didn't apply to anyone who ventured, via one of the new bridges, like Waterloo or Blackfriars, Westminster or Hungerford, into the Wen of Lambeth. The village thus fast became known as a site of revelry and abandon, a place where public houses, brothels and lewd theatres abounded, and where a man could find entertainment of all kinds, and disease of all varieties, for no more than a handful of pennies. To see a play that wouldn't pass muster with the London censors, to be able to drink absinthe into the small hours of the morning, to buy the choicest pornography newly smuggled from Paris, or to have a girl of any age and not be concerned that a Bow Street runner, as London's early police were known, or her parents might chase after you, you went Surreyside, as they said, to Lambeth. But, as with most slums, its cheapness attracted respectable men to live and work in Lambeth too, and by all accounts, George Merritt was one of them. He was a stoker at the Red Lion Brewery. He'd been there for the previous 8 years, employed all the time as one of the gang who kept the fires burning through the day and the night, keeping the vats bubbling and the barley malting. He was 34 years old and he lived locally at 24 Cornwall Cottages on the Cornwall Road. George Merritt was, like so many younger workers in Victorian London, an immigrant from the countryside, and so was his wife Eliza. He came from a village in Wiltshire, she from Gloucestershire. They'd both been farm labourers and, with no protection by unions, no solidarity with their fellows, they'd been paid trifling sums to perform humiliating tasks for pitiless masters. They'd met at a farm show in the Cotswolds and had vowed to leave together for the immeasurable possibilities offered by London only 2 hours away on the new express train from Swindon. They moved first to North London, where their first daughter, Claire, was born in 1860. Then they shifted into the city centre, and finally, in 1867, the family having become too large and costly and manual work too scarce, they found themselves near the brewery site in the bustling sty of Lambeth. The young couple's surroundings and lodgings were exactly as the illustrator Gustave Doré had drawn on one of his horrified expeditions from Paris, a dim world of bricks and soot and screeching iron, of huddled tenements, of tiny backyards, each with a privy and clothes boiler and washing line, and everywhere an air of damp and sulphurous stench, and even a rough-hewn, rollicking, hugger-mugger, devil-may-care, peculiarly London type of good cheer. Whether the Merritts missed the fields and the cider and the skylarks, or whether they imagined that that ideal had ever truly been the world they'd left, we'll never know. By the winter of 1871, George and Eliza had, as was typical of the inhabitants of the dingier quarters of Victorian London, a very substantial family. 6 children, ranging from Claire at nearly 13 to Freddie at 12 months. Mrs. Merritt was about to be confined with her 7th pregnancy. They were a poor family, as were most in Lambeth. George Merritt brought home 24 shillings a week, a miserable sum even then. With rent payable to the Archbishop and with food needed for the 8 ever-opened mouths, theirs were straitened circumstances indeed. On the Saturday morning, just before 2 a.m, Merritt was awakened by a neighbour tapping on his window as prearranged. He rose from bed and readied himself for the dawn shift. It was a bitter morning, and he dressed as warmly as he could afford, a threadbare greatcoat over the kind of smock jacket that Victorians called a slop, a tattered grey shirt, corduroy trousers tied at the ankle with twine, heavy socks and black boots. The clothes were none too clean, but he was to heave coal for the next 8 hours and couldn't be too bothered with appearance. His wife recalled him striking a light before leaving home. Her last sight of him was under one of the bright gas lamps with which Lambeth's streets had recently been equipped. His breath was visible in the cold night air, or maybe he was just puffing on his pipe, and he walked purposefully down to the end of Cornwall Road before turning into Belvedere Road. The night was clear and starlit, and once his footsteps had faded, soundless, except for the clanking and puffing of the ever-present railway engines. Mrs. Merritt had no reason to be concerned. She assumed, as she had for each of the 20 previous nights on which her husband had worked the dawn shift, that all would be well. George was simply making his way as usual towards the high walls and ornate gates of the great brewery where he worked, shovelling coal beneath the shadow of the great Red Lion that was one of London's better-known landmarks. There may have been little money in the job, but working at so famous an institution as the Red Lion Brewery, well, that was some reason for pride. But that night, George Merritt never reached his destination. As he passed the entrance to Tennyson Street between where the south side of the Lambeth Lead Works abutted onto the north wall of the brewery, there came a sudden cry. A man shouted at him, appeared to be chasing him, was yelling furiously. Merritt was frightened. This was something more than a mere footpad, that silent and menacing figure who lurked in the dark carrying a lead-tipped cosh and wearing a mask. This was something quite out of the ordinary, and Merritt began to run in terror, slipping and sliding on the frost-slick cobbles. He looked back. The man was still there, still chasing after him, still shouting angrily. Then, quite incredibly, he stopped and raised a gun, took aim and fired. The shot missed, whistling past him and striking the brewery wall. George Merritt tried to run faster. He cried out for help. There was another shot, perhaps another, and then a final shot that struck the unfortunate Merritt in the neck. He fell heavily onto the cobbled pavement, his face down, a pool of blood spreading around him. Moments later came the running footfalls of Constable Burton, who found the man, lifted him, and attempted to comfort him. The other policeman, William Ward, summoned a passing hansom cab from the still-busy thoroughfare of Waterloo Road. They gently picked the wounded man up from the ground, hoisted him onto the vehicle, and ordered the driver to take them as fast as possible to St. Thomas's Hospital, 500 yards further south on Belvedere Road, across from the Archbishop's London Palace. The horses did their best, their hooves striking sparks from the cobbles as they rushed the victim to the emergency entrance. It was a futile journey. Doctors examined George Merritt and attempted to close the gaping wound in his neck. But his carotid artery had been severed, his spine snapped by two large-calibre bullets. The man who had perpetrated this unprecedented crime was, within moments of committing it, in the firm custody of Constable Tarrant. He was a tall, well-dressed man of what the policeman described as military appearance, with an erect bearing and a haughty air. He held a still-smoking revolver in his right hand. He made no attempt to run, but stood silently as the policeman approached. "Who is it that's fired?" asked the constable. "I did," said the man, holding up the gun. Tarrant snatched it from him. "Whom did you fire at?" he asked. The man pointed down Belvedere Road to the figure lying motionless beneath a street lamp just outside the brewery's store. He made the only droll remark that history records him as having made, but a remark that, as it happens, betrayed one of the driving weaknesses of his life. "It was a man," he said, with a tone of disdain. "You do not suppose I'd be so cowardly as to shoot at a woman?" By now, two other policemen had arrived on the scene, as had inquisitive locals. Among them, the Hungerford Bridge toll collector, who at first hadn't dared go out for fear I'd take a bullet. And a woman undressing in her room on Tennyson Street, a street in which it was apparently far from uncommon for women to be undressing at all hours. Constable Tarrant, pointing towards the victim and ordering his two colleagues to see what they could do for him and to prevent a crowd from gathering, escorted the supposed and unprotesting murderer to the Tower Street police station. On the way, his prisoner became rather more voluble, though Tarrant described him as cool, collected, and clearly not affected by drink. It had all been a terrible accident. He'd shot the wrong man, he insisted. He was after someone else, someone quite different. Someone had broken into his room. He was simply chasing him away, defending himself as anyone surely had a perfect right to do. "Don't handle me," he said, when Tarrant put a hand on his shoulder. But then, rather more gently, he said to the policeman, "You haven't searched me, you know." "I'll do that at the station," replied the constable. "How do you know I haven't got another gun and might shoot you?" The policeman, plodding and imperturbable, replied that if he did have another gun, perhaps he'd be so kind as to keep it in his pocket for the time being. "But I do have a knife," replied the prisoner. "Keep that in your pocket also," said the stolid constable. There turned out to be no other gun, but a search did turn up a long hunting knife in a leather sheath strapped to the man's belt behind his back. "A surgical instrument," it was explained. "I don't always carry it with me." Tarrant, once he had completed the search, explained to the desk sergeant what had happened on Belvedere Road a few moments before. The pair then set about formally interviewing the arrested man. His name was William Chester Minor. He was 37 years old, and as the policeman suspected from his bearing, a former army officer. He was also a qualified surgeon. He'd lived in London for less than a year, and had taken rooms locally, living alone in a simple, furnished upstairs room nearby at 41 Tennyson Street. He evidently had no financial need to live so economically, for he was in fact a man of very considerable means. He hinted that he had come to this lubricious quarter of town for reasons other than the simply monetary, though what those reasons might be didn't emerge in the early interrogations. By dawn, he was taken off to the Horsemonger Lane jail, charged with murder. But there was one additional complication. William Minor, it turned out, came from New Haven, Connecticut. He had a commission in the U.S. Army. He was an American. This put a wholly new complexion on the case. The American legation now had to be told. And so, in mid-morning, despite its being a Saturday, the Foreign Office formally notified the U.S. minister in London that one of their army surgeons had been arrested and was being held on a charge of murder. The shooting on Belvedere Road, Lambeth, already because of its rarity a cause celebre, had now become an international incident. The British papers, always eager to vent editorial spleen on their transatlantic rivals, made hay with this particular aspect of the story. "The light estimation in which human life is held by Americans," sniffed the South London Press, "may be noted as one of the most significant points of difference between them and Englishmen, and this is a most shocking example of it brought to our own doors. The victim of a cruel mistake has left a wife near confinement and seven children, the eldest only 13, to the mercy of the world. It's gratifying to be able to record that the benevolent are coming forward with alacrity to the succour of the widow and the fatherless, and it's most sincerely to be hoped that all who can spare even a trifle will do their best to help the victims of this dreadful tragedy. The American Vice Consul General has, in the most thoughtful manner, opened a subscription list and issued an appeal to Americans now in London to do what they can to alleviate the misery which an act of their countrymen's has entailed." Scotland Yard detectives were soon put onto the case, so important had it suddenly become that justice was seen to be done on both sides of the Atlantic. Since Minor, silent in his prison cell, was offering no help, except to say that he didn't know the victim and had shot him in error, they began to investigate any possible motive. In doing so, they uncovered the beginnings of the trail of a remarkable and tragic life.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.